Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening and welcome everybody to tonight's program at the Commonwealth Club. My name is Saran Yitbarek. I'm the CEO and founder of Code Newbie, and I'm pleased to be your moderator for tonight's conversation. Joining us is Clive Thompson, a columnist for Wired, longtime tech contributor to the New York Times Magazine, and author of the new book, Coders, which hopefully you've heard of by now, The Making of a New Tribe and the Remaking of the World. Yes, yes, very nice book, very nice cover. A recipient of the Knight Science Journalism Fellowship at MIT, very fancy. Clive has spent the majority of his journalistic career reporting on technology and a self-described computer geek from way back. Coders is a unique look into the culture of a seemingly exclusive industry. He talks about the good and the bad, how coding has opened new avenues of opportunity to different groups of people, and also how the field has shut out and discouraged the participation of others. We are very grateful to have him here tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Clive Thompson to the Commonwealth Club.
Thank you.
There you go.
Thank you.
Can I put the book right here?
Yeah,
is that okay?
Absolutely. Yeah.
As you can see, I have read the book. I have taken lots of notes, and I'm very excited about it. I'm going to put this right
there. I showed
right
up, and I was
there.
Like, Saran, man, you have done your homework. Right?
There's like, yes, I have. So one of the things that I love about this book is that you cover a lot of stuff. You cover gender, you cover race, yeah. You cover AI, you cover the history. I feel like you went through every single decade and had some type of historical perspective on everything from the beginning of computers. And so I want to know, how did the research begin for you? What was the starting point?
In a weird way, the research probably began like 40 years ago when Commodore 64s came out and you could plug them into your TV because like that was, I'm 50 years old, so that was literally my generation of introduction to coding was this moment when it was like, you know, it became a mass thing, mm-hmm. you know? And so what when I was a kid, I was keenly aware that these were crazy and interesting devices that compelled me. They gave you this enormous feeling of creativity and control, which you don't get much when you're 12 years old. And I probably would have done this for a living if my mother hadn't said to my father, we cannot have a computer inside the house because he'll just play video games and drop out of school.
Were they right? Is that what they were
not entirely wrong. Given I used to vanish into arcades, you know, for like, you know, days at a time. So I put it in my pocket, right? And I went off to become a writer. But when I graduated, I just remained fascinated by, you know, what computers meant for society. And I started writing about it. And over again, I would run into these, you know, really interesting developers who were building stuff, beginning like in the 90s with web stuff and carrying on. Mm-hmm. And sort of what became clear over time was that the average person really had no idea how software comes to be. Like, it's just this absolute mystery. Mm-hmm. They don't know.
It's a black box.
It's a black box.
Yeah.
They don't know who's doing it. They don't know why mm-hmm. those people get interested in it. I knew enough about the allure of why that was narcotic and interesting because of my own experience and having talked to all these people that I really wanted to put that together and sort of show people who are the folks that are behind all these transformations of society.
Mm-hmm. So when you decided that you wanted to share this information with people, where did you begin? You kind of had to infiltrate these coding communities. Where did you start?
The low-hanging fruit was people that I knew. So people that I'd talked to before, you know, like Bram Cohen, you know, the creator of BitTorrent, right? You know, I had years ago, I'd profiled him for Wired. So I sort of did, you know, what they often call anthropologists or sociologists would call it a snowball survey where you start with one person, like, who else do you think I should talk to? And then you just keep on going and going and going, right? Mm-hmm. So some of it was that, but also I really wanted to, you know, get a soup to nuts view, which is to say from the people who are kind of at the in these catalytic roles, like at the very large tech companies, like the people building AIs for Google, you know, people who had put together Facebook's newsfeed, these, you know, Twitter, these very large companies, all the way down to, you know, the guy slinging JavaScript for your local bank, mm-hmm. right? Because I really wanted to get a sense that there was this ecosystem. Mm-hmm. So I worked hard at trying to get a very wide view of it. Some people, you know, were very happy to talk. Others, like Mark Zuckerberg, were not particularly interested in talking. I said to Facebook, I said, look, you know, I'd love to chat with him. And truthfully, given that most of the time people interview him, they want to talk about stock valuations or whatnot. I said, I'm the last person on the planet who actually wants to talk to him about coding, right? You know, he's going to go to his grave never being asked about that. It did not move them.
Okay. Well, what's interesting is that you didn't just study coding. You code a little bit yourself.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Actually, show of hands in the room. How many people have coded before? Show of hands.
Okay, there we go.
There you go. Yeah, so you're amongst your people. Yeah, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, okay, so like I said, I did this when I was a kid. I dropped it, you know, for my 20s and 30s. And then so my 40s, I decided, you know, I wanted to learn more about it and do more of it because of me talking to people. I also wanted to sort of know some of the more modern languages. I mean, like I did Fortran on punch cards, right, which is not exactly contemporary. So very weird high school curriculum in 1980s in Toronto. So I was learning, you know, JavaScript and Python and whatnot. And I quickly set about discovering that, you know, it was actually more fun than writing, you know, by a country mile. I would procrastinate on writing my book by sitting around writing weird little tools for myself. Because, you know, when you're writing, you know, writing has no proof of success, you know, like, I write a column for Wired. Was it a good column? You know, did it work? I don't know. You know, that's up to you guys. It's a completely subjective thing. Whereas when I would write some little tool for myself, you know, once it was working, it was just working. And it had this crisp finality to it, that you know, no one could come to me and say, yeah, that weird tool's not working. It's working. I don't have to argue about it. So that was sort of pleasant and fun, and I found that more fun than writing. I still sort of do. I was telling Sron earlier that earlier this week, I found myself doing that neurotic thing that authors do where you sit at your Amazon page, you know, refreshing it over and over again to see if the sales rank has gone up. And I thought, you know, this is completely unhealthy. So let's automate it. So I wrote a little scraper that goes in and grabs the text I'm looking for and formats it and texts it to me.
Much healthier.
And I thought originally I should have this fire, you know, every 7 minutes all day long. Scaled that back to 4 times a day. It's like cognitive behavioral therapy through code, right? You know, while I was writing it, I was aware, wow, I'm out of my mind. But now I don't have to think about it, you know. That was more fun than anything else I've done this week, actually. Except for this.
Of course. I know you meant that, yeah. What's interesting is that when you write, you get to share that with tons of people, millions of people, right? But when you're coding these little things, no one really gets to see it. Did that factor in at all?
No, in a way, no, because, you know, I wouldn't want anyone to look at this code. It's horrible. I wouldn't want anyone else to rely on it. I think there is one sense in which writing is like the pleasures of software deployment that the people I talk to would say, which is that there is this joy in making something public, right? I mean, I enjoy writing when it gets out there in the sense that there's this thing going around in the world I'm getting reactions from. And over again, I would hear the same type of thing from developers. That one of the things that was enormously delightful was this sense that they were doing something in one corner of the world that would sort of be used everywhere, you know? There's a story in the book where I was at Instagram talking to Ryan Olson, one of the developers who did Stories. So like Instagram basically rolled out this thing. It was, you know, sort of a direct copy of Snapchat, but they did a good job. And he had just finished like the sort of death march of like, you know, 5 weeks of not sleeping. And so I was interviewing him. He was all bleary, but he said there was, you know, something I heard often. There was this pleasure of like he'd get on the subway and he'd see someone pull out their phone and, you know, use Stories. And there was something amazing to him about the scale of being able to do something in one place and then just see it everywhere. Mm-hmm. And that's a little bit like writing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in the book, you talk about this idea of a 10X engineer, which is kind of a common topic, right? This idea of a person who is just such a superstar who can do the work of 10 other engineers. Mm-hmm. But you also briefly mention a 1X engineer. And the idea of a 1X engineer is someone who's maybe not really the superstar.
Yeah, yeah.
And the example you gave was David Crowley, who created Dodgeball.
That's right.
Who then created Foursquare.
That's right.
So,
yeah.
And it was interesting because that story about Dodgeball and the code was so terrible. He showed it to these Google engineers and the engineers validated that it was terrible. But he created Foursquare.
Yep. Yeah. 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 So Dennis Crowley, amazing story. Sort of a friend of mine. I met him back in the Dodgeball days. So I called him up because he had once said to me, he said, like, you know, I'm the worst programmer I've ever met. And I was like, okay, I need to get that story into the book. And it's true. Like he had tried. He tried to study computer science. Could not pass even the first course. Would try and teach himself stuff. He could not get. He goes, I could not get any code to compile. Tried to get into MIT. Didn't have the chops to get into MIT. Finally, sort of just, you know, brute forced his way into learning a little bit of ASP because he had a vision, right? He had this. He was a guy who liked going out in New York in nightlife. He liked going to bars. He liked finding out where his friends were. And he had this idea of, like, you know, wouldn't it be fun to know where everyone else was? You know, in this kind of, he described it as, like, you know, the Marauder's Map from Harry Potter, mm-hmm. right? You know? And so, you know, he had this cultural thrill that he wanted to create. And so he was just willing to bash his way through and create whatever janky scripts were necessary to make it work. And the thing that was so valuable, I think, about what he did and what he told me was that, you know, his actual coding skills were terrible, but he had something that was perhaps even more valuable, which is he had an interesting thing that he wanted to make happen that was valuable to a lot of other people and brought a lot of joy into people's lives, right? You know? And so, you know, they were bought by Google and Google brought them in and they do the code review and they were like, wow, look what we bought here, you know, 1,000 lines of insane PHP. But, you know, they were kind of aware that, wow, this is nuts. But they had respect for it, you know, because they were like, sure, we've got, you know, a company full of like 10X engineers. But, you know, but what's valuable is knowing something, you know, solving a problem or creating an opportunity or a new experience for people with code. That's valuable, and it doesn't matter if you're a 1X engineer if you have that idea.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So you talk a lot about women in tech in this book. There's a whole chapter dedicated to the ENIAC girls, which is fascinating. And what I loved about the way you approach that topic is that I always assume there were one or two major reasons why there aren't many women in tech why they're underrepresented. But you really broke it down and you show that there are kind of like 100.
Yeah.
There are lots of variables, lots of things that came together and created this unfortunate storm that resulted in the low numbers we have today. But one of the interesting phenomenons that you talk about is the pink collar worker.
That's right.
Tell me a little more about that.
Yeah. So this is a really interesting thing that's happening right now. So you have this problem where like women are early pioneers in coding. And then for, as you pointed, a whole complex bunch of reasons I'm not going to go into now. You can read the book. They're driven out. One of the reasons why it's actually hard to talk about and understand and fix is because it's not just one thing, and so you have to move on five or six fronts. But, you know, there has been, in recent years, you know, a couple of areas of software engineering that have had a lot more women involved, partly because the doors have opened. Front-end engineering, you know, JavaScript, HTML, CSS, you know, has a much higher representation of women, partly because, you know, it was something that you could sort of, you know, brute force your way in. If you like started doing websites for people and you began to like get really good at JavaScript, you didn't need to have the big CS degree. And so the door was sort of more open. And also there's just frankly this crying need for a lot of warm seats to do that work. But, you know, that's great. There's way more women involved there. Way more other underrepresented groups, but when you actually look at the pay, what starts to happen is more women flood into that area. The pay softens, right? So you know, certain areas become new high yield areas where the priestly class goes off to, like blockchain or AI, and front end design. You know, the pay doesn't match, and so this is what several thinkers. Who I talked to for the book said this is sort of almost like a pink collar ghetto, right? In coding, and it becomes an interesting challenge. You can open the doors, but there's still a lot of pre-existing problems in society overall over the way that women's work is valued that extend outside of the world of coding that infect it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you also talk about the blue-collar worker as well, which is kind of related, a little bit different.
Right.
This one relates more to like boot camps and that phenomenon.
Yeah,
Tell us about that.
Yeah. Right. So one of the other thing that's happening in software right now that's quite interesting is, you know, there's these different waves of the reasons why people decide that they want to get into this. 40 years ago, it was people who were just sort of germanely interested in hacking. As a few of them said to me, you know, who are now in their 50s, when I did this, when I was a teenager in the 80s, you know, it I had no idea this would have any financial value. It seemed as useful as like arts criticism or something like that, or, you know.
No offense.
Yeah, my wife is, in fact, actually an arts critic. So they sort of stumbled into making a lot of money. 10 or 15 years later, it became clear that in the 90s and early aughts that there was like millions of dollars at hand here. So you had a lot of kids flooding in going, wow, this is how I'm going to make my $1 million. The thing that's really interesting in like maybe the last 5 years, post the 2008 financial meltdown, is that it's become clear that there's a certain chunk of people that are interested in getting into coding because it's almost like it's just a middle class living, right? Mm-hmm. Like they don't want to get rich. They just want a stable job that will pay well, that's intellectually interesting, that is less precarious than the crazy service sector economy loaded down with student debt that confronts them. Now, this is really interesting because this is like coding becoming something that's more like working on a Chrysler line in the 70s, like a very, very skilled, high-paying work. And there's very different motivations. Also, because, you know, the number of jobs there that are necessary, that are open, the computer science schools can't satisfy that demand. There needs to be different ways to get in. And that's why things like boot camps have started to emerge, because they're trying to satisfy that demand, to give people just enough skills that they can get in a junior job and move on. And of course, it's kind of a dodgy thing, because these are, unlike universities, these boot camps are completely unregulated. The good ones are amazing. The bad ones are just fly-by-night operations that take your money and leave you with nothing. And it feels like an area that perhaps state and local governments should take a closer look at, mm-hmm. because they could get a little more involved in incentivizing the good actors and expanding the opportunities, because it when it works well, it's a viable route. You yourself know, right? You went to a boot camp.
Right? Yeah.
Exactly. That's how you got in, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's this very interesting quote from Jacob Kaplan-Moss, who's a pretty big deal in the Python community. And he says in your book, programming is something you are, not something that you do.
Right. Well, to be fair, he was saying that with concern. He was saying, mm-hmm. this is the view that he finds, that he worries about, the idea that that you're only a real coder if you sort of have this personality. You know, it is sort of a persona that you have. It's not just an activity that you do. Mm-hmm. And the story here when he said that, it's in a fascinating essay. It's online. You could hunt it down and read it. He was at a conference, and there was a woman, a young woman, who got up and talked about a project she'd done, where she had to create her own system for logging a bunch of GIS data and parsing it and doing data viz on it. So, like, this is a complicated project. Like, she'd worked with, like, you know, three or four different languages and frameworks and put this thing together to accomplish this task. She was presenting on it, and she concluded by saying, you know, like, you know, I hope you enjoy this. He talks to her afterwards and says, you know, would you like to be interviewed at my company? Because this is like a remarkable work you've done. We could use developers like you. And she said, well, I'm not a software developer. You know, mm-hmm. Like, I just sort of did this thing. And he talked to her and realized, you know, she had internalized this idea that comes off the industry that, like, you know, a coder is, you know, this shoegazer, arrogant, mostly young male nerd, right? And if you don't match that type, you're not really a real coder. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's all this bellicose chest beating about the type of languages you should be doing if you're a real coder. And this goes back decades, right? I'm going to mangle. I've never pronounced Edward Jigriska. Okay, someone pronounce that for me. His last name, Edward Jigriska. What's his last name? Jigstra, there we go. Okay, so he wrote this essay about how BASIC and COBOL cripple the mind, right? You know, and these are the languages written for newbies, right? And so he was, you know, doing his thing, saying, you know, that's not real coding. Mm-hmm. You know, these languages that were designed to let everyday people do coding, that's not real coding. So this idea goes back very far. I think it's completely hazardous, and it chases people out of the field.
Yeah, and what's interesting is, in so much of the book, there's this theme of underdogs, right? There's the women in tech who were part of the pink collar ghetto. There are the blue collar workers who might be doing the quote unquote easier technology and kind of not doing the blockchain, the AI, the harder stuff. Mm-hmm. And there are the 1Xers that we talked about, of folks who aren't necessarily the superstars. Mm-hmm. So when you think about these underdogs, where do they fit into the future of coding?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, frankly, they would fit in absolutely fine if the industry and the people that hire had a more expansive view of where talent comes from. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things to me that is so interesting about looking back at the origins of coding, like late 1950s, early 1960s, is that it was like wildly meritocratic, right? Like, because there was no preconceived notion of who a coder was. In fact, you couldn't even study it. There wasn't any degrees, right? You know, they didn't start doing computer science degrees until the late 60s. Anyone who just sort of could say, "Hey, I want to do this," and could prove that they were pretty good at, at sort of logical thinking, could get a job. There's this story in the second chapter of my book, wonderful story, Mary Ellen Wilkes. She went to college thinking that she would be a trial lawyer in the late 50s, and everyone told her, there's no chance of this happening. They don't make women trial lawyers. And so eventually she decided, okay, I can't do my dream, so what should my fallback plan be? And she thought software. Because back then there was really no sense that you couldn't do it. So on the day she graduates, she has her parents drive her from the graduation ceremony to MIT, and she walks.
I like her.
Yeah, she's great. Yeah. She walks into the hiring office and says, so do you need software programmers? And they said, yeah, we do. And so they went and they gave her an interview and they did some logic tests, and she was a great logical thinker. She studied philosophy. And they hired her, and she became this absolute titan of early development. She wrote the operating system for the Link, one of the first ever personal computers. She was enormously in demand. She eventually went off and in the 70s became a trial lawyer, finally, when the field had sort of eased up enough. But think about that. It's 1960. This is like the Mad Men period. And software is such an open door and so interested in just identifying merit that MIT will take a young girl who's just graduated and said, let me do this. So to me, that's actually the spirit that the industry should be embracing mm-hmm. today, you know? And when they do, it works incredibly well. One of these companies, Catalyte, that I found, they're in Baltimore, they decided kind of to return to exactly that sheer merit reward. They set up their own system for testing people for aptitude, and they put ads in local newspapers and said, "Do you think you want to do software?" And they would have them do this test with the promise that if you scored highly on it, they would offer you a training period, and if you completed it, they would guarantee you a job. So now, years later, they have 600 developers. I think it's about 39% African-American, 45% women. These are numbers that are insanely unheard of in the rest of the industry. And they're doing work for Coca-Cola and redesigning the front end for Grubhub and stuff like that. Because it turns out that if you just ask people if they want to do it and they prove they have the will and the aptitude, they're going to be great at it. Mm-hmm. That is what the industry needs to move towards.
So I want to talk about the business side of things. There's a tech firm founder who said, if you aren't aiming to be giant, why bother doing it? Which is a little pessimistic, a little cynical maybe.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because we hear about these big tech companies, the Googles, the Facebooks of the world, the Amazons of the world, mm-hmm. and it feels like they're kind of eating up the little guys and eating up these tech companies that maybe could be like middle-sized, right? They could be mid-sized companies. They could stay small, and that's fine too. Mm-hmm. But where do you see the future of it? Is there room for the little guys to stay? What does the ecosystem of tech companies look like?
I mean, I do worry about that. I heard this from a lot of people that were involved in different, you know, parts of the stack. If you've got a niche you're doing and it's outside the ambit of the big tech giants, you know, you can probably continue what you're doing forever and it'll be great. But if you're doing anything that bumps up against what one of these large tech companies like Apple or Google or Facebook or Microsoft is doing, you know, they'll sort of just reach out and phagocytose you with a you know, mountains of money.
That's what I like to do on a Friday night.
Yeah, exactly. One of the concerns is, what's that doing to the competitive landscape? Like, could there ever actually be a competitor mm-hmm. to these large companies? One of the lines of thought amongst, you know, thinkers like like Susan Crawford or Tim Wu, is that maybe, you know, we're moving into a period where we need to take antitrust enforcement a little more seriously. You know, no one really knows what that would look like. Is it breaking up a big company? Is it requiring that a large company give access to some of its data such that other smaller companies can compete by having access to it? No one really knows what it looks like. But it does worry me, because I think that, like, you know, there's this concern that, among my mind, that you could have actually a stagnation of inventiveness, because it's too hard to do something that could grow to compete with these giants, basically.
So what happens if we are unable to compete? What does that mean for our future? What does that look like?
Well, it doesn't presage good things, right? Because whenever you have, you know, we know this from the lessons of history, from other industries, ranging from transportation to mining to telecommunications, that if you have an important area of the economy, of the civic realm, that's dominated by a few players, they have outside power, and you're sort of left to do all this special pleading to get them to change their ways. And that doesn't always work very well. One of the rays of hope, or green shoots that I've seen that emerged just as I was writing this book was that, and this is not by any means sort of a solution to the problems of size, but a lot of, you know, grassroots employees have in the last 2 years started, rising up at some of these large tech giants and saying, you know, we're not happy with some of the ethical and moral implications of what this company is doing. Mm-hmm. You know, so at Google, you had an uprising against the idea that they were going to be doing AI for the military. You also had a big uprising about the fact that they gave a $90 million golden parachute to someone that was being let go for sexual harassment. Mm-hmm. And that ranged from petitions to people quitting to, like, thousands of people walking out around the entire planet. At Microsoft, you had petitions saying, you know, we are not happy that our productivity software is helping make ICE more productive at deporting migrants, right? This is really interesting and kind of new. Like, this is not something that was happening at these tech companies 5, 10, 15 years ago. And I think it's because the generation of developers and tech people that are working for them are coming in understanding that these companies have an enormous impact on the economy and on the civic realm. You know, when I mentioned that guy earlier, you know, who's in his 40s at Uber, who said, you know, I never imagined software would become so valuable. If you're 25 and you're working for these tech companies, you don't have that illusion. You grew up knowing that this stuff is incredibly powerful, because it was what powered your socializing when you were a teenager. It's what powered potentially your gig economy jobs. And so I'm actually kind of heartened by that. It's kind of cool to see a bunch of people, the worker bees, the people that are moving the bits around, begin to exercise some of their agency inside the companies.
Why did those issues become issues when they did? Because I'm sure that's not the first government contract that was controversial.
Yeah.
It's not the first ICE contract that's happened, right? So was there something about the timing of that you found was interesting or unique?
I think it's probably because of the discussion about the concern of what social media did during the 2016 election. You know, that was catalytic. That was a moment when a lot of people began inside the industry began to say, "Wow, this is freaky." I mean, there's these funny stories that, like, people would tell me, you go to a party now in Silicon Valley, and the Facebook people show up, and you ask them, "So where do you work?" And they're like, "Oh, you know, in software. what company? You know, we do stuff." like 10 years ago, they would have, you know, been like, had the T-shirt
been
on,
proud
you know,
of it,
and now they're just sort of, you know, keeping the hat down low and, you know, drinking their beer in the corner. I think what sort of happened after the election was this kind of moral shock to the system that may play part of what's going on. Because as you point out, like, you know, certainly with military contracts, I mean, technology down to the microchip was based on, you know, boatloads of military money. That's not a new thing. What is new is a concern about the ethical implications of it.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of those issues have to do with privacy, and you have an entire chapter dedicated to privacy alone.
Right, right.
And you talk about these pro-privacy hackers who mm-hmm. feel very strongly that consumer privacy needs to be more of a priority and that the government needs to be more transparent.
Right.
And you set up these, or you go through these battles between these hackers and government, these hackers
and
the music industry, these hackers and the entertainment industry.
Mm-hmm.
Where do those battles, where did that leave the little guys, the average coders, the average consumers?
Yeah. Well, the average consumers, I mean, in one sense, are sort of just hapless, you know, standbys in this, right? Because, you know, really this, what you're talking about here, and this is my, in one sense, this is my favorite chapter to write, because it was, you know, all about these very civically minded, you know, coders who are like often, you know, working for free or working with nonprofit organizations to try and create, you know, crypto to improve privacy, to improve autonomy. So, you know, it was the one chapter where I'm like, oh my God, I'm actually really enjoying this a lot, you know, as opposed to some of the other chapters where it's like, oh, this is kind of a slog. So in one sense, it was nice, but you're right, there's sort of a lack of agency for the average person. You know, it feels like, you know, if someone is concerned about privacy online, if they're concerned about how their data is being used, they're concerned about how they're being tracked, they don't really have a lot of options other than what, you know, massive tech companies are offering them, mm-hmm. which is, you know, essentially surveillance capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And the sort of attempts by these pro-privacy hackers to create tools that you know, pull back a little bit of control, you know, you know, with some success, you know, Signal, for example, has grown mm-hmm. dramatically in usage. Those are fantastic hackers. They've done amazing work. I think in one respect, probably what's left for the rest of us is for it to become a bit more of a political issue, right? I was kind of fascinated to see that Beto O'Rourke was a member of the Cult of the Dead Cow, you know, writing essays about the end of money and whatnot, because I'm like, that's really interesting, you know. I would personally like to see these issues around data, around the enormous, you know, social control of these large companies become much more something that's talked about, you know, as a political issue. It isn't right now. You know, you really don't find, like, you look at all the arguments that are being posed towards a potential, you know, Democratic challengers for the presidency. And, you know, there's a lot of good, important stuff there, but you don't see these issues talked about very much. And you know, it is the one lever that the people have against enormous corporations is the Leviathan of government, right? You know, it's one of the few large, one of the few forces that can go toe-to-toe with enormous corporate interests. So, you know, not the most satisfying answer to that question, but that is one of the few levers the everyday people have, is mm-hmm. to turn it into a real political issue.
Mm-hmm. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 500 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now, back to our program.
One of the more complex topics that you tackle in this book is AI and big data,
mm-hmm.
and how AI can really help us do lots of fun things like translate in real time. It can help us, you know, identify things in photos, but it can also really affect our lives in positive or negative ways, like showing us specific job postings and making courtroom decisions, which is a little scary, a little terrifying.
Yep.
There's this quote from Kathy O'Neill that, like, frankly haunted me. It says, big data processes codify the past. They do not invent the future.
Right, exactly. This is something that's actually existentially striking and alarming about the way that a lot of machine learning is being used these days, which is to say, you know, machine learning and neural net, you know, machine learning in particular, is kind of it's a weird form of software. It kind of unsettles a lot of coders I talk to, because they're accustomed to, like, building these watchwork systems that are deterministic, that do what they intend to. You know, but when you're training a neural net, it's like training a puppy not to pee on the carpet, right? Like, you know, you sort of smack it when it pees, and then you reward it when it doesn't pee. And at the end of it, you've got like a neural net that's doing what you want it to do, right? You know,
That's how I trained my husband.
There we go. And so you show it like a million cat photos, and you're and then when it gets it right, you know, you backpropagate, you know, and when it gets it wrong, you backpropagate, and eventually you have a neural net that can recognize cats, but you don't necessarily know how it's doing what it's doing. So you have a bit of a black box. But also, you know, if it's doing a recognition that's based on historical data, it cannot deviate or make moral judgments about that. So one of the examples you mentioned about offering jobs came from an example, it's mentioned in the book, where they trained, they were interested in classifying job offers and matching job offers to candidates. So they trained it on all this existing data. And what it started doing was recommending much higher wage jobs to men and much lower wage jobs to women, because that is the record of the past, right? If you look at the record of the past, women are paid less than men for the same jobs. If you train a classifier on historical data, all it's going to do is replicate the errors of the past, right? So that's actually, when you phrase it that way, that's actually kind of existentially horrifying, right? You know, to be using software that reifies our past errors, that reifies our past biases. And of course, you know, you see it anytime someone trains visual recognition on a whole bunch of white folks, and they wind up with what Google ran into, where they have a classifier that labeled a black developer and his friend in Brooklyn gorilla. The reverse thing happens, by the way, in China. You know, they train classifiers on tons of Asian faces, and it literally can't recognize white faces, right? You know, so whatever bias you put into it will come out the other end if you don't carefully correct for that. And the industry is not great at thinking about, you know, those problems of the complexity of data, how to get it, how to clean. Data scientists are good at that, I would say. But, you know, product companies are not.
So a lot of this technology is already out there. It's already infiltrated so much of our society. If we see these issues and these patterns that we're not happy with, is there anything we can actually do about it, or are we too late?
Are we too late? In some cases, it is about mitigation, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you take a look at something like Facebook's newsfeed, and what they've done over years is carefully torque this algorithm so that it tries to find things that are engaging. Well, what tends to be engaging are things that have extreme emotionality, right? They make you laugh uproariously. They make you angry. They make you, you know, pissed off. And you know, we probably could have seen that coming. But they're now at the point where it's deeply entrenched in their business model. And so there's five or six things you would have to fix if you wanted to change that. You might want to think about that business model. You know, anytime you are trying to, you know, satisfy advertisers by getting them to get people to click on things all the time, you are going to run into these problems. Particularly if you don't have an existing moral or civic dispensation to your task at hand. I mean, we were talking about this in the green room a little bit. One of the funny things about the news industry where I work is that they've spent years wrestling with this problem of, how do you get people to look at stuff? Really a newspaper over the years would constantly be like, you know, they'd love to just give you comics and sports sections, right? Because that would get you to buy a lot of newspapers and sell a lot of ads. But they have this idea that they also wanted to educate you. So, you know, they have this A section that you have to sort of fight through with news about Afghanistan so you can get to the comics, right? And they set up this system where there was a publisher who was responsible for making the money and the editor that was responsible for figuring out the coverage. And they sometimes sort of hated each other, right? Because the editor is running stories about why Toyota's latest car is a death trap, and the publisher is trying to sell an ad to Toyota, and so you know they did it imperfectly, they did it badly a lot of the time, but they actually had thought through the civic and moral implications of the business model. That did not happen with any of these companies. You know, could they adopt some of that orientation? Could they sort of try to do that? You know, sure, I think they absolutely could, but the leadership would have to want to do that, and there's no indication that they will. Bloomberg had a story today, kind of an unsettling story, about how a lot of developers lower down the food chain at YouTube were discovering that, wow, our algorithm is just kicking up a lot of conspiracy theories all the time. They kept on bringing it to upper management, and they just kept on saying, we don't care. You know, people are clicking on that stuff. Our goal is to get the, you know, 1 billion hours of viewing. If that's your goal, if your sole goal is that 1 billion hours, then, yeah, you're going to wind up with, like, you know, the moon landing was fake.
It's interesting because we talk a lot about how technology is shaping what we do, but you talk a lot about how technology can be a reflection of what we do. There's this really interesting quote that I found fascinating. It says, I'm not racist. This is a woman working in AI. Her name is Robin Spear. She says, I'm not racist, but what if racism is correct?
Right, right. To be fair, that wasn't Robin herself.
It wasn't. Okay.
She was paraphrasing what people said to her. She had actually done she was working on a classifier that was trying to take like Yelp reviews, and what she was finding, because she was using a lexical parser that came out of some Google work, that it was automatically classifying Mexican restaurants as being worse off than Italian ones or whatnot. Why? Well, because it had been trained on Google News, and Google News is filled with all sorts of overly sampled stories about, you know, in Mexicans being involved in crime and whatnot because they have racist editors assigning this coverage. And so the classifier had learned racism, and it was saying that, you know, Mexican restaurants were somehow worse than other ones because the word itself, Mexican, was worse. So she presents this online, writes a good essay, and, you know, the denizens of, like, Hacker News are like, well, you know, maybe that's just reality. You know, maybe, you know, like, maybe people really are racist, so our classifier should just, reflect that racism. And Robin was saying, well, that's not going to fly. You know, like, I have customers that are interested in getting a view of reality that's not inflected with the crazy racism filtered, distilled through tons of news stories. What she was pointing to is that there are moral decisions in the way you make software, moral decisions in the way you weight your AI, and it is incumbent upon developers to think about that stuff and not to wave it away.
Developers, it seems like, throughout the book want to play this role of translator between the technology and the consumer, where their job is simply to bring the technology to reach its potential almost. And they kind of want to get out of the way. They're the interface, the layer between the consumer and the technology itself.
Yeah.
How do you understand that relationship?
Sorry, repeat that one again. I don't think I quite got the...
Sure. So what I want to know is, when you think about the role of developers, they seem they want to be bystanders, right? They want to sit back and
they
go, well, this
solve
is just
the way
to exactly.
Give me the problem, I'll solve the problem. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I agree. I mean, I think to a certain extent that is an extension of the engineering mindset, you know, historically, right? You know, all throughout, you know, the history of engineering, the goal was often, I have a problem here to solve. I have something I'm trying to make more efficient. I'm trying to, remove grit and friction. And that goes back to, the steam engine and signals processing, right? Not. And so it, you know, when you're faced with just technical challenges, it can be very hard to look up at the larger view. One thing that I found really, really interesting was this, this paper that, I'm forgetting his name now, a computer science professor sent to me. And he had been thinking a little bit about the comparison between, software engineers and physicists. So physicists in the early 20th century really were just had their heads down solving interesting problems, like how does the atomic world work? How does this stuff, you know, function? And they were sort of so interested in cracking that nut that it wasn't until the atom bomb went off, they began to realize, oh my God, there are huge stakes in what we've been doing for the last 30 or 40 years. And they had this reckoning that went on for a decade or two that had some really interesting side effects on physics as a discipline, at least as this author put it. He was, he'd been a physicist himself, and he'd noticed that, like, say, in the 1980s, when they were doing, you know, divestment campaigns on campus, right? Like, student activists were trying to get campuses to divest from South African companies during apartheid. And the student activists would go to all the different, all the different faculties and say, you know, hey, English department, hey, sociology department, you know, would you support our push? And none of them would, except for the physicists. The physicists would all sign on. And And he said it's because they had a moral reckoning and they began to realize that there are that they have some obligations to society at large, and they think about those things. And the conclusion, and maybe we can leave things here and go to questions because we're getting near the time, is that he said, you know, software engineering has not had that type of a moral reckoning. It has not had a Hiroshima. It has not had a moment where they sat back and went, oh my goodness, look at the massive social impact. And so it's still too interesting to just get in and solve the problems. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, you don't want to have something that big, but maybe that's what you need. I don't know.
That is a great place to transition into audience questions. Absolutely.
On that cheery note.
On that cheery note.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I think 2016 was a part of that for sure. Okay, so this question reads, what role will groups like Code for America, Black Girls Code, et cetera, play in helping level the playing field in the future?
I think they're incredibly important at one part of that puzzle. And that puzzle is giving young people the opportunity to sort of get that hello world bolt of electricity when you realize, oh my God, this is fun, right? You know, like this is genuinely fun. This gives you these, I see in the audience here, someone who's in my book, Dave Guarino. We were emailing and he said he'd realized what software was, and it's the pleasures of agency, right? It's the pleasures of being able to make things happen. And you can only decide that you want to devote your life to that if somewhere along the line you get the opportunity to feel that. So all those organizations are actually, I think, doing that with a lot of young people in a great way. There's still a lot of other things that have to happen. You know, the way things are taught, computer science education has to change a little bit. Certainly hiring and the way that these companies visualize what a developer looks like has mm-hmm. to change. But what these groups are doing is fantastic. Mm-hmm. Question.
Marshall McLuhan states that a generation's favorite games are extensions, reactions to social life. As the Minecraft generation now reaches the job plateau, how will the technically inclined among them shift this profile of the coder that you've outlined?
Well, it's the same type of thing. I mean, like, so I wrote a big story about Minecraft a couple of years ago, and it was completely fascinating to do for a couple of reasons. One is that, like, that game has a huge blast radius, and I was finding it kids who were addicted to it in every demographic group and every socioeconomic group. Like, it was, you know, the wealthy kids of Montclair, New Jersey. It was kids showing up at the library in Harlem in low-income areas, and they were all super into it. And it reminded me a little bit of kind of what I saw in the scene of people, you know, coding in the Commodore 64s back in the 80s, right? Like, it has a real inventive feel of, like, what crazy things can we do inside Minecraft? Because it's not just building blocks. Like, there's literally a coding language built into it with this wiring that forces you to literally write, you know, and or XOR gates, you know, by hand to make doors open and whatnot. So I would encounter these kids that were like, they were like literally the ENIAC programmers in the 50s. They were laying down wiring to make their logic, right? Mm-hmm. So that was incredibly fascinating. And a friend of mine, Ian Bagos, said, yeah, this isn't just a game. This is this generation's, you know, personal computer, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it's actually things like that that can have a bigger impact sometimes even than education, right? Because that's this weird moment where you get again that hello world thing, and it's happening in this effortless way amongst all sorts of different kids in different groups. I'm very heartened by it. Ian said, you know, it'll be a couple years. He's kind of wondering what's going to happen when the first kids show up, and he teaches computer science, who sort of learns some of this thinking in Minecraft itself.
Mm-hmm. You spoke about the social conscience of coders, especially young coders, to influence the behavior of large tech companies. Why do you also believe we need more regulation when it seems like the industry is trending towards self-regulated morality?
Well, I'm Canadian, so I believe in regulation, right? You know, I'm a strong believer in a free market that is just going gangbusters with guardrails set up by intelligent, competent government. Competent being the main word there, right? You know, I frankly would like to see a much higher level of digital literacy amongst our representatives, and I would like to see a much higher level of digital literacy amongst you know, even the bureaucratic areas. Now, so you know, Is there a role for more government, you know, in helping to solve some of the problems? There probably is. Again, I think particularly at the antitrust level, I think anytime you have massive actors that essentially have monopoly or monopsony power, you need to start looking at that as a recourse. Do I know what that would look like? No, I don't, because I've asked a lot of people. I've said, you know, what would antitrust enforcement look like? There are not a lot of good answers yet. I think that conversation has just begun. It might take a couple of years. But I do believe there's some role there.
Mm-hmm. We talked about AI, so this question is excellent. Are privacy concerns about AI valid or exaggerated?
Privacy concerns. I mean, when I think about AI, I don't necessarily immediately turn to problems in privacy, apart from the fact that obviously it can be a way to, you know, very efficiently and effectively sort through data to find out things that someone might otherwise prefer hidden, right? There's this sort of phrase known as retrospective surveillance, you know, where just you have a big bucket of data about what someone, you know, what someone's been doing online. And then, you know, if you suddenly take an interest in them, you just sort of, you know, set your search algorithms, you know, to find, well, what can we find interesting with this person? This is exactly how the Soviet Union used to work, right? Like lots of files on people. Wow, Clyde's become troublesome. Let's see what's in his file, right? So in the sense that AI is, modern AI and machine learning is really good at finding connections. And if it's a nice black box machine learning thing, it'll find things that no one can explain how the hell it found. It's probably dangerous in that regard. You know, when you're talking about preserving privacy, you're talking about transparency, not to black boxes. That would be the concern I see there.
Mm-hmm. How concerned should we be about China surpassing us in the coming year?
Oh, very, very concerned. I mean, like you know, China has an extraordinary capacity for throwing resources at things. When I spoke a little while ago to Baidu, I was asking, so how many people have you kind of got working on, you know, machine learning, you know, like, or deep learning? It's like, oh, about 2,000. And that was just kind of in one chunk of one lab. They are really good at doing industrial policy in a way that the U.S. is not. They are really good at devoting resources and finding areas and honing in on them. They have a massive, massive market in their own growing middle class that is, you know, very lucrative to work towards. They have a government that has not a whit of care for civil rights and has actually pioneered a form of surveillance and control of online discourse that is being, you know, excitedly copied by despots around the world. So yes, I think actually China is a very, very significant concern, because if they wind up becoming the big innovators in a lot of areas, they will be operating not remotely with some of the concerns. I mean, we talk about, like, you know, companies like Facebook or Twitter being, you know, problematic for society. That is not a whit on what, like, you know, a Chinese government approach to surveillance online is like.
Mm. What do you think about the oncoming IPO craze in San Francisco? So things like Lyft, etc. Will it change the city forever?
Forever is a hard thing to judge. Will it change things, you know, for the worse in the short term? Absolutely. I mean, it's going to crap, you know, tons of more millionaires out on the street trying to buy houses, bidding it up, and the city's not building anything at all. I mean, it's an absolute mess. It's like ungovernable at this point in time. I'm from New York, which is a horrible place to live in many ways, but at least they build housing, you know? It's like, you know, like a few blocks from my house, there's literally about, like, you know, probably like 1,500 units going up in condos in like a 6-block area. And they're not like low income, you know, units by any means, but they will at least relieve the pressure on the low income units further out, because, you know, all the sort of, you know, symbolic analysts want to live near the subway. So they're going to live in those places. They're not going to push further out. Yeah, it's going to be a problem forever. You know, in the long run, we're all dead, as Keane said, but, in the short run, we're alive, and it's going to suck.
We're having a lot of cheery conversations.
Can someone be like, you know, something, some levity in it here? Yeah.
Okay, this one I think is a little bit lighter. What do shows like Silicon Valley get right and get wrong when it comes to coders in Silicon Valley?
In a weird way, I think they did a pretty good job.
They did a really good job.
And a lot of developers
can't watch it.
When I was talking to them, they were like, this is great. You know, they were really good at a couple things. So one is they were really good at capturing the sort of zeal for optimizing stupid things, right? You know, there's that scene at the, I think it's the end of the first season, when they're about to go to TechCrunch, and their compression algorithm is simply not working very well, and they. It's kind of hard to talk about this scene in public company.
Or is it the best thing to talk
about? Yeah, maybe. So the public head of the company says, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to do something intimate with all 400, you know, people in the audience to get them to like us. And the other, you know, their coder's like, well, you know, is that even possible, you know? And so they immediately start trying to solve, for what's the optimum way for him to do this to all 400 people. I swear to God, I've been in conversations that were like that, right? You know, I've watched people just go off the rail. You say, make some stray comment, and they're off to the races, trying to, like, literally figure out how to highly optimize and make efficient that system. Of course, in the middle of it, he has an epiphany about how to change the software, goes into a room, puts his headphones on and starts hacking. And the other ones are eventually like, where is he? And they, you know, kick down the door. He doesn't notice because he's got his headphones on. And they go, oh, my God, don't bother him. You know, like, and they put the, which is exactly, again, they sort of captured the fact that when people are doing the work, you know, don't tap them on the damn shoulder, right? You know, when they're 12 hours in, you know, this is when the real work is happening. So there's just a lot of little things like that. I think they did a really, really good job.
I know a lot of coders who cannot watch Silicon Valley because it's just too real.
Well, this is like Eddie Van Halen with This is Spinal Tap. He like broke into tears like 10 minutes in and had to leave. He's like, I can't. This is exactly what it was like being on tour with Van Halen. And it's it pierces me to my very root.
I want to challenge the Kathy O'Neill comment that big data processes codify the past. All the examples you discuss demonstrate the opposite.
Oh.
That because of big data, long-standing biases become evident and can be discussed and changed.
Interesting. That's not untrue, assuming that the people deploying the stuff have any sort of introspection at all. They often don't. But I would make a defense, though, of machine learning as a counter force to human biases, right? So, like, you mentioned sentencing software, you know, that tries to figure out, you know, what is someone's chance of recidivism and to offer a score to the judge to help the judge figure out, should we give this person a light or a heavy sentence? And on the one hand, that sounds kind of awful, right? Like, you know, how could this software be anything but unbiased? But if you did it right, it wouldn't be a bad thing to counteract the actual known biases of the human judges, right? So studies have found that if you go before a judge for sentencing just before lunch and they're hungry, you get a worse sentence, right? Like, and we know this. Like, this has been tested, right? I mean, humans are terrible, filled with all sorts of unconscious biases, you know, stupid activities. So if we could find a way to, you know, algorithmically, actually, and in a reasonably fair way, offer additional data to help us guide our judgments, I mean, I'm all in favor of that.
So I've got one more question, but there's a word that I am having trouble reading because of the handwriting, so this person can speak up. Thoughts, insights in the something word, need for embedded ethical training in undergraduate computer science program.
Oh, yeah, sure. This is a great point. You know, one of the things that so a friend of mine, Anil Dash, he's the CEO of Glitch, a tech company, and he's been in social software for a long time. And he goes, you know, one of the problems is, you know, and he talks about himself, like he was involved in, you know, early blogging software, and he watched all this stuff happen. And he realized, you know, part of the problem is he and, you know, every other not so much he, but you know, other engineers he sees coming out of these CS programs, you know, they're really, really good at data structures and algorithms, but they really haven't had any training in the big picture of how society works. And so he's like, you know, they should really have a little bit more of a breadth requirement here, right? You know, the reverse could be true, actually. The people in humanities should probably, you know, it'd be fun if they had a bit of a taste of, you know, engineering to understand what it can do. But yeah, like a small number of computer science faculty and departments have started experimenting with the idea of, well, what if in addition to the data structures and algorithms, we had some courses on, you know, history, sociology, society, psychology? That would be great, you know, because then you'd get people that are, you know, have the hardcore engineering skills that have been asked, you know, routinely to stop and think about the broader picture, the world that their work is going to enter into and the effect they're going to have on society, and frankly, just how messy and weird people are, right? You know, if you're going to ship any code that affects how people talk to each other, how they do things, you're going to have a lot of weird unintended consequences because we humans are filled with unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. So I'm all in favor of that.
So what's interesting about you writing this book is that you are not new to technology. You're not new to coding. You code yourself. You've been a tech reporter for a long time. What was the most surprising or interesting thing that you learned while writing this book?
You know, in a weird way, the most surprising thing was people would ask me, like, all right, so, you know, what's it take to be a good developer? And they'd often have this idea that you have to be very logical and systematic. And that's true. And they would, you know, say, are you have to be really introverted? I'm like, well, no, not really. You know, like a lot of them are, but it's not a prerequisite. The one thing that came incredibly clear from talking to like 200 developers was that you had to be really, really good at enduring unbelievably brutal levels of frustration. Because there was almost nothing more frustrating you can do with your life than try and tell a computer what to do. Because anytime you get the slightest thing wrong, it's like, nope, nope. You're stupid. You're wrong. I'm not doing what you say.
It's always right.
Exactly. And so if Jeff Atwood had said, you know, the reason why we're all assholes is because we deal with an abusive colleague all day long, you know, which is a computer, right? You know, you know, you try dealing with this thing all day long and see, you know, how you turn out, right? And so I actually thought, A, that was funny and interesting. B, I grew to really admire the, you know, the ability of all these developers just to pound nails into the floor of history with their forehead. And I also realized that maybe that's a message that should percolate outwards a little bit, which is that, you know, if you're interested in, you know, learning and doing this, you know, it's enormously rewarding. It has all those hello world delights and joys. But wow, it's going to test the fiber of your very soul, right? And so that was surprising and sort of inspirational in a way. I found that I sort of grew to really admire that about developers, their enormous persistence in the face of failure.
Do you think that more people should learn how to code?
Yes. I mean, not in that sense of like, I think everyone should do it because they might, you know, become a developer. I think that's not, you know, likely to happen at all. Only a small subset of people will ever be really interested and devoted enough to make it their life's work. But I actually think in a weird way, it's enormously useful knowing a little bit of it, because you can start to, like, you know, automate and make more efficient and sort of all these little things you do with your life, like constantly check the status of your book on Amazon, right? Over and over again, I would encounter these people who had just learned just enough Python to sort of, you know, take like 5 hours of scut work they used to have to do as a job as an accountant or a marketer and, you know, automate it really quickly. And there was something, you know, pleasant about that, something fun about that. It made them more effective at what they do. It made them feel more empowered. So I'm a big fan of saying, yeah, learn a little bit of it, you know. Maybe you'll discover that this is something you want to do with your life. Maybe you'll just discover it's a fun thing to do in some corner of your life the way I use it.
How has writing the book and researching for the book affected your relationship with technology?
You know, I think in some respects it has made it more complex, the way that anytime you learn something about something, it makes you more aware of what's going on. I think in some respects, I had always known that software is sort of amazing, that it works at all. Like, it's so ridden with bugs, you know, beginning to end, that you're kind of astonished that the stuff works at all. That, in some respects, really came home, the more I talked to developers, partly because the nature of development has changed. You know, 30 or 40 years ago, you were writing stuff right down to the metal. You know, like, you need a web server, you better write one. You know, you need an email server, you better write one. But now a lot of development is like layers and layers and layers of people using libraries on top of libraries and really not having the faintest idea what's going on in those stacks down there. And there's something sort of wonderful about that because people can be much more productive more quickly. Something a little terrifying about that because you realize that the potential for things going wrong is sort of bigger and bigger. So every time I encounter software, I'm sort of literally wondering, wow, what demons lurk deep in, you know, beneath the weeds of this? And I'm sort of amazed when it works. Maybe it's more appreciative that stuff works as well as it does.
Mm-hmm. Our thanks to Clive Thompson, journalist and author of the new book, Coders, for joining us this evening. Thank you so much. We'd also like to remind our audience that copies of his book, Coders, are available for purchase, and he'll be happy to sign copies outside in the library in just a few minutes. I'm Saran Yatbarek, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Was this a meeting? That's right. It was actually a meeting.
This is a meeting.